Pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Mike Am from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. You probably don't want this.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Mike, I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. By the grace of a loving God and good sponsorship, I've been sober since October 4th of 1992, and I'm pretty grateful for that. I hope that my life demonstrates my gratitude to my God and to Alcoholics Anonymous for my sobriety, because that's a fact. I am very grateful for my life today and for what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. Do you mind? It's hot. I won't tell that part of my story. It's good to be here. Thanks for the 10-minute talk, too. That was a good talk. I don't know if we'd have got along or what would have happened there, but it was a good talk. I'm a guy, too, who doesn't remember my first drink of alcohol. I'm from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. My home group is a Crossroads group in Urbana, Iowa, a little town north of there. I don't know what you'd be doing in Urbana on a Sunday night in Iowa, but if you're ever there, look us up. We're an active little group out in the rural communities in Iowa. We're a group that believes in the fifth tradition and carrying our message into institutions and doing that. So if you're ever up that way, look us up. Be glad to have you. I was born and raised on a farm. My first experiences with alcohol, like I say, I can't really bring too many memories to them. My parents had a bar in the basement, and I just know as a young lad, I would go down there with my buddies, and we'd mix up god-awful drinks with whatever was behind the bar and drink it. And I know even a few times I drank too much as a young lad. The first memories really that I can bring to my mind that I can articulate anyway with booze was when I was about 12 years old, and I was at a hog roast at my buddy Mike's house, and it was a big party. There was cars up and down the gravel roads, and they roasted four or five hogs and had, I don't know, 20 or 30 kegs of beer and a live band and stuff. It was a nice party. And Mike and I started out the night, we were going around filling the older people's glasses up with pitchers. We were beer runners, essentially. We'd go back and forth from the keg to the tables and fill the older folks' glasses up. Now, at some point in the night, I ceased to be a runner of beer, and I became a drinker of it. And a lot of things happened to me that night that happened over the course of about the next 16 years. One of the things that happened is I drank too much. I know today what that's about. I have a body that doesn't metabolize alcohol like a non-alcoholic would, and I experienced the phenomenon of craving that night, and I drank a lot of beer. Another thing that happened to me that night was my buddy Mike and I thought it'd be a good idea to have a hay rack ride. So we hooked up the 4020 John Deere to the hay rack and threw a few bales of hay on it and pulled up to the party and, you know, whoopee, come on, we're going to go have a hay rack ride. And Mike's dad didn't seem to think that was as good an idea as we thought it was. And I remember the look. You know that look that we got from the people that loved us? That look of disdain or disbelief? I remember that look like it was yesterday from my Uncle Bob. And he was walking up to the hay rack, and I was straddling a bale of hay, and I had my pitcher, and I had already thrown up on myself by that point. And he just had that look in his eyes of why are you doing this? Why are you embarrassing yourself and your parents and stuff? And another thing that I remember from that night is at some point in the evening, I got thrown in the back of a car, and I remember I was vomiting looking down on the gravel, and I remember when somebody turned me around and laid me in the seat, I was looking up at my mom, And she was saying something, but I don't remember what it was. And then the next thing I remember is being carried into our home and being put to bed. And the next memory I have of that first run was I woke up the next morning and swore off of alcohol. Man, I felt bad. I drank a lot of beer that night before. And that was my first real run with booze. And it was earlier in that evening, I had the experience that a lot of us had. It was like I could come out and play. And it was really a neat experience, but from the gate, I just overshot that mark. So I swore off alcohol, and I didn't drink for a short period of time after that. I'm not sure how long. But I know that the very next opportunity, or the next time that I started drinking, it was insane. As I got into junior high school, I began to be a daily drinker, which seems almost impossible to me. As I look at my nieces and nephews today, and even my son Chance, who's 13 now, by the time I was his age, I was a full-blown drunk. And I look at them kids now and think that it just seems impossible that at that age I could have been that way. I went to a small school, had 28 people in my graduating class, and that was with a foreign exchange student. So we were a little school. It was K through 12 in one building, and even as a youngster then, I remember I had dreams. I would watch the high school guys walk down the hall, and they'd have those letter jackets that made all the noise when they walked with the metals clinging together. And I looked at them guys with some awe, and I aspired to be that. I'm going to do that. You know, I can do that. I can do track and baseball and basketball. And another thing that was attractive about that to me is they seemed to have the nice-looking girls under their arms. And so I had dreams of doing that. By the time I'm a freshman in high school, I'm already selling my dreams down the river. I'm beginning to just quit sports entirely. It's really something that interferes with a good bender, you know, to have to go to track practice or something and run after you've been out drinking for 3 days. It just isn't a good mix. And so I just quit. And that's about the time in my life that I just kind of raised my middle finger to the world. I can tell you that prior to that, I had a good upbringing. My hero then was my granddad, and we had two family farms north of this little town, and we worked those farms, and I have really good memories of that, of getting on the tractor with my granddad and going out and mending fence and chopping thistles and walking beans and baling hay and doing all that. So it was really good. We had a little farm pond. We used to go down and catch frogs and turtles and fish and stuff. So it was a good deal. Have some really good memories of that. And my granddad, I just absolutely looked up to him. He's a stellar man. He talks about three times slower than I do. And I generally talk slower than I am right now, but you guys make good coffee. I had two cups of that stuff before the meeting. Ooh. Wow. Sophomore in high school, we start a little gang. Not a gang that you might think of in Las Vegas. We weren't out taking over casinos or into drugs and money and all that. Our little gang was about drinking. And we had a name. We called ourselves the Odushi Brothers. And I still don't know what that means. And neither does anybody else. I've asked them all. We don't know. But what this gang had, a little hierarchy. It had a president, a vice president, a presidential bodyguard, secretary, treasurer. And how you moved up in the gang is you outdrank the guy that was ahead of you, right? And I don't know if I'm proud to report, but I was president of the Odushi Brothers from its conception. I must have been at the party where we started it, until I went off in the Navy about 2 years later. And I always kind of thought that there was something macho about that. And there's a lot of guys that tried to outdrink me. In fact, they'd plan it, and they'd get me on back-to-back-to-back-to-back nights and try and get me, but none of them could outdrink me. And that's because I have alcoholism. There's nothing macho about it. I'd be dropping them off at the end of their farm lane at 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, and I'd still be out drinking until I was done. And I could never predict that. But it was fun. We had a lot of fun drinking and cruising around on the gravel roads and dirt roads and building fires out there and drinking, you know, finer wines like TJ Swan and those things that never saw a grape. But it was fun. I did start to get into a little bit of trouble at school, with grades and stuff, and of course with the law. They were pretty forgiving in that little farming community of 600 or so people. My mom was president of the school board, and my brothers and sisters all excelled, I guess. They got through school and everything without problems that Mike was having. And they let me off a lot, even times they would take me home. A lot of times they would take our beer and just go dump it or something, tell us to go home. But we'd usually go get more and be right back out there doing it. When I was a junior in high school, I figured that Iowa was my problem and I needed to go off and do greater things. So I joined the United States Navy on the delayed entry program, and I took some college classes. Halfway through my senior year, when I turned 18, was off to the Navy. I had to meet with the school board to do that, and their very words to me was that they thought that discipline could do me good. So they agreed to let me graduate early and go join the Navy. And my first, I went to San Diego to basic training, and then back up to the Great Lakes to A school, and really did okay through basic. Got to A school and started drinking again, and when I got my ship assignment out in Alameda, California, we started to go into San Francisco, and I used to hang out in the local bars, the bars in the community where people really didn't ask you, you know, what you did for a living and stuff. It was kind of the dark places. And that's where I met my first wife. She was my drug dealer. There was a guy on my ship who, he was a pretty smart guy. He was from Tennessee. We called him Tennessee. And he said, you know, if you're married and you're in the service, your paycheck doubles. All right? So that, I mean, I calculate that out to more booze and drugs. And so I asked this gal if she'd like to make $100 a month, just extra. And, you know, we were sitting at the bar one afternoon just completely sloshed when I'm asking her to do this. And I explained, you know, the situation to her, and we wrote up a little contract on some paper that the bartender gave us, and we bought a guy a couple seats down a drink to witness it. And so then we went and got on a bus and went to Reno, Nevada, and got married. And I'm not proud of we almost got thrown off the bus several times on the way out there. And when we got there, you know, we don't have rings. or any kind of plan. We just show up at one of these little wedding chapels. And I guess they're familiar with people like us because they even had plastic rings for us to use. But the guy said, he did his thing and he said, "You can kiss the bride." And I said, "No, thanks." It wasn't my type of girl, you know what I'm saying? But she had good drugs, though. So we got on a bus and went back to San Francisco. And shortly thereafter, my ship moved home ports down to Long Beach, where it got insane for me. I started to get in a lot of trouble with the Navy several times in front of the captain. And at that time, I'm 19, I think, 19 or 20 years old, and they saw a young guy who was in a lot of trouble, and they tried to help me. They sent me to a three-month inpatient treatment center at the Naval Hospital in Long Beach, California. I got orders to go there, and I left my ship Thursday, and my orders said that I needed to be there by, like, midnight on Sunday. And so me and a guy named Michael from Ohio went on a run, and I just showed up there at midnight, like 2 minutes before, and had my sea bag on my shoulder. And I mean, I was done or I wouldn't even have showed up, you know what I mean? Stumbled off the elevator and threw my sea bag down, and this poor little girl at the desk didn't know what to do with me. She went and got the guy that was on duty. He was a big Navajo Indian, biggest Indian I have ever seen in my life. Man, this guy was big. Big shoulders and a big square jaw. And he came out and wanted to know why the hell I showed up drunk on his watch. And I wanted to tell him something. I thought he was going to crush me with his thumb or something. But you know, the book talks about once in a while he may tell the truth. And the truth is that we really don't know why. And for some reason, I just told him that. I said, "Man, I don't know. I don't know why I showed up here drunk." And the instant I said that, his whole demeanor changed. And I didn't know it at the time, but I know today that that's the first time that I looked into the eyes of an alcoholic, into the eyes of a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He understood that. I didn't try and feed him any line of crap. Just simply the truth. I don't know. This is what I do. And his demeanor changed then. They got me down to detox. And so I spent the next 3 months in that treatment center where I was introduced to you in Southern California. They took us to meetings 6 nights a week. And on Wednesday nights, they brought in a meeting into our institution. And it was okay. I'm the guy that wasn't ready yet, though. I remember I always sat in the back of the room kind of with my arms crossed and a little uneasy, and I didn't really want to be there. In fact, they had a liquor store right across the street. If any of you were in the Navy and went through that naval hospital, you probably utilized that liquor store like I did. I would go over there and buy bottles and sneak them in my room and drink. It's amazing that they didn't catch me. But that group of AA members that came in there on Wednesdays, I remember one night they were talking to us about slogans. You know, sometimes you see these slogans on the wall like, "Let go and let God," right? First things first, turn it over, you know, and what I want to do is go turn their table over that they're sitting at. And they said one thing that I really didn't understand. They said, "One day at a time." They said, "All you got to do this is one day at a time. And if you can't do that, do it 1 minute at a time or 1 hour at a time. And if you can't do that, just break it down and do it 1 minute at a time." And I completely didn't understand. I understand that principle today that I get to live in the consciousness of the presence of my God one day at a time. It's not about fighting booze. But what I heard them saying then was, "Mike, you got to go the rest of your life, one day at a time, 1 hour at a time, 1 minute at a time, fighting booze." And I knew as a 19 or 20 year old kid that that's a battle I'm gonna lose every time. But my hand went up. I think it's the first and only time that my hand went up in that treatment center. And I said, "Hey man," I said, "what about Super Bowl?" Right? "What about New Year's Eve? What about my birthday? What about if I ever get married?" And I meant like for real. "You're telling me that I can't even have a glass of champagne." I just completely could not imagine life without alcohol. So I naturally, I didn't do real well there. When I got out of there, I was two steps out of that door, and I had a cold can of Budweiser in one hand and a big fat joint in the other, and off I was going. Shortly thereafter, our ship went overseas to the Philippines, and this was about the sixth time that I had been there. I had a four-day pass. I left the ship in my dress whites. I came to out of a blackout, I think, in day two of that deal. And I was surrounded by Filipino national police with their guns drawn on me. And I had no idea what I did. You ever come out of a blackout in a spot like that? It's like you just don't know why. But I did what anybody, I guess, would do, is I just raised my hands and they searched me, and I read the report later. They pulled their guns on me because they needed to take control of the situation. When they searched me, they found what the report said was a bag of leafy green vegetable substance. And they took me to a prison. What they told us going into the port over there, you know, they show you the movie of the STDs and all this stuff. And they also tell you that if you're caught over there with any drugs or drug paraphernalia, you're going to do 6 years in their penitentiary, and there's nothing we can do about it. It's a third world country. This was back in the early 80s. And so I'm sitting in a one-room dirt floor cell with no running water. They had stripped me down. There's another guy in there, a little Filipino guy who was stripped down too. And it was scary. If you had to go to the bathroom, you just kind of hunkered down against the wall or something. There's no toilet. And they also told us that if you get in trouble over here like that, that if you don't have somebody to financially support you, you will starve to death because they don't feed you. You got to have somebody paying them to feed you. So I'm wondering if my family back in Iowa is going to take care of me, and how this is all going to work out, because I'm looking at 6 years in this deal. I was scared. It's the most scared I had ever been in my life up to that point. And I had had some run-ins with the Marine MPs a couple times before this, but I can tell you I was never so grateful in my life to see a group of Marine MPs come in there and shackle me up and take me out. You know, I was really glad to see them come. And the only reason that I didn't have to do any more time in that prison over there is we had an air base there at that time, and they had worked out something with our government that if the military guys got in trouble over there, they'd turn them back over. So I did some time in the Marine Brig system, which really sucked. That was a bad deal. And the Navy dealt with me appropriately. I'll say this about the Navy, that's a good outfit. For a lot of years, I talked bad about that. But that is one class outfit that did what they needed to do with a guy like me. And they needed to clean it up, and they did. I'm a guy, when we were out to sea, I had my wife back in San Francisco, who I would have her send me drugs and like cookie boxes and stuff. And I was in charge of this pump room down at the bottom of the ship, and I made homemade wine down there. So I had a still going down in the pump room and bags of weed coming and stuff. And I would be down there during unreps. I was on an oiler, and you know, we got about 8 million gallons of fuel and about 2 million gallons of jet fuel on that thing, as well as ammunition, and I'm down in those pump rooms. I had no regard for my life or yours. I'd be smoking cigarettes down there with 8 or 10 inches of fuel sloshing around in the bilges, and I'd just toss my cigarette in there. I figured if we blow, we blow. That was my attitude. Total disregard for life, out of control. So they dealt with me appropriately. I spent a little bit of time in Southern California, a little time in Ohio, a little time in Oklahoma. Back to Ohio, back to Iowa. And a couple times in there, I'd go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not really wanting to do anything different. I went a couple times to get a court paper signed, and that was about it. Ended up back in that small farming community that I had grown up north of. And I'm going to go to my last run with booze here. I was living above, we had two bars in that town, and I was living above the lower bar, which was convenient, right? But I was, I don't know, I was a half a year behind in rent. Once in a while, somebody would come up there and live with me and pay the guy that owned the place some money, and I just wasn't paying rent. I would bend nails from time to time to make money, but was really unemployable. I just couldn't hold jobs very long. And my last run, I lived in this little room in the back, and it was really hot. I think it was August, and I was sitting back there, and somebody had fronted me some drugs that day, and I had a run with needles. I was sitting back there sticking needles in my arm and sitting against the wall, and I'd fire up, and I'd just bang my head against the wall, and I had beer there too. I was drinking beer and smoking cigarettes, and I'd fire up and bang my head against the wall, and sometimes just kind of sink down into myself. I'd done enough crap that day. I should have been, I should have been having a party, right? I can tell you that my hero at that point in my life ceased to be people like my granddad, and it became guys like Jim Morrison. I mean, I just took it to the edge. And I did everything in that little room back there, and I got up and I went to the refrigerator and opened the door. And there was two beers in there, and I think a thing of mustard in the drawer, you know. And I grabbed one of those beers, and I went and sat. There's a little bay window that sat out that I could look up and down the street of this little town. It was right above the bar sign. I got this bar sign glaring about 3 feet below me, and I popped that beer. And I felt a terror run through me that was even stronger than that time I was in that lockup in the Philippines. I didn't understand what that was about, but this loneliness settled around me. It's almost like somebody wrapped a blanket, a cloak of darkness around my, I mean, it all just really sunk in, and I got tears running down my eyes, and I was just absolutely terrified. I didn't know why at the time. I think I do today. Is because I knew that other beer in the refrigerator wasn't going to end this run. And to the best of my knowledge, nobody in Benton County was taking any more of my checks. I had an $800 bar tab up at the corner bar, and they weren't allowing me to charge any more liquor up there, and it was about the same down below. So I didn't know where I was going to get my next drink. That was the start of my last run. I don't remember my last drink. I've talked to some people who were around me at that time in my life, and the best that we can come up with there is that went on for about another 18 months. And a few times in that time frame, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, not wanting to drink anymore, not wanting to live in the madness. And this is what I heard. And I know that this could simply be my perception, but this is what I heard when I went to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. there was a real emphasis on meeting attendance. Go to more meetings. Just go to a lot of meetings, kid, you'll get it, right? Like put the plug in the jug, go to 90 and 90, a lot of that stuff. And I would sit in the local clubhouse in Cedar Rapids and I'd go to 3 meetings a day. I'd really sit there in fear of the next drink. And that night I'd be out drinking, wondering what in the hell was wrong with me. Why couldn't I get this? On October 4th of 1992, something different happened, and I don't even know why I went to that meeting that night. I have no idea. I had absolutely no plans for my life. It was of no good virtue on my part to do something different. I think really what happened to me that night is I just had some instinct within me that said I needed to live. And I found myself back at that clubhouse that night, and something different happened. And here's what happened. A guy told me something, and I think it's as important as what he didn't tell me as what he did. What he didn't do is he didn't sit at that meeting that night and tell me stuff from across the room. Are you with me on this? He didn't sit there and say, keep coming back, it'll get better. He didn't sit there and say, go to 90 and 90. He didn't talk to me across the room with solutions. What he did is after the meeting, he came up and took my hand and introduced himself to me and asked if I would like to go talk, said he'd buy me a cup of coffee. Nobody had done that. And I learned something from that. You'll never hear come out of my mouth at a meeting, keep coming back. I certainly hope everybody does, but there's enough people saying that. And what that does to me is that alleviates my responsibility of going and 12-stepping you after the meeting. If I'm just sitting across the room from you, keep coming back, kid. You know, I might as well say, screw you, I don't really care about you. Right? That's how I look at that. Right? So he took me that night and properly 12-stepped me into Alcoholics Anonymous. He spent 3 hours with me. Drinking bad coffee over at a Hardee's restaurant. And he had done what I had never had this experience before. He talked with me about what his drinking was like. He talked to me about what his drinking was like. He didn't talk to me about my drinking. He talked to me about his drinking. He talked to me about what happened as a result of him coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I seen a guy sitting across the table from me telling me the story that was a different guy. He was changed. He was incapable of the things that he told me he did out there drinking. And it hooked me. I haven't had a drink since that night. When we parted company that night, in the parking lot, I asked him, I said, Don, what do I do now? What do I do between now and 4 o'clock tomorrow night when we're going to meet again? Because my experience shows me that I'm going to be drunk. And here's what he told me. He said, I think when you get home tonight, you should pray. Okay. I said, it's been a lot of years since I did that. I said, how do I pray and what do I pray for? He said, it's very simple. Just get on your knees and ask God for help. And that's what I did. I went down and knelt down next to this rickety old torn up couch I had been living on and said that prayer, God, please help me. In Bill Wilson's story, he talks about how God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound, and I had a similar experience. A lot of us do. I stood up from that prayer, free man. The madness was gone. And I had some knowings when I stood up. I stood up, and I was just sobbing like a little kid. It was incredible. Wilson talks about how the clean wind of a mountain blew through and all that, and the room lit up. The room didn't light up, and the wind didn't blow, but it felt like it did. I felt lighter. I felt at ease. I had a sense about me. There was only two thoughts in my mind. I remember this clearly. There was two thoughts in my mind, and I'm used to about 100, right? And one of them was, you can go the rest of your life without drinking. That was my mind making sense of being relieved of the obsession to drink. And the other one was, you need to be as involved as you possibly can be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And from that day to this, I have been. That guy got me really active in the fellowship. He got me real active in going to institution meetings. The second night sober, he had me in a treatment center. It was a step meeting. I didn't really have anything to share, but he took me along, and thank God for that. I had an intuitive thing that I needed to be in the big book and try and do some work out of there, so I stuck my nose in there and started doing some work out of there. Wasn't really a lot of that going on, it didn't seem like, up in my area at that time. In fact, when I got to my third step, I told that guy that had 12 step, I says, you know, it says in here that we might want to do our third step with somebody else. And he said, really, show me where that is. So I showed him where that is, and we did the third step together right then in the car. And then I got busy writing inventory. I finished my inventory at about 6 weeks sober. And, you know, I had some things on there that I didn't really want to share with anybody. I thought at least I could get out of Iowa or something, right, or self-centered stuff. But I seen a flyer on a wall at one of the clubs about a men's retreat about three quarters away across the state. So I loaded up my inventory and got in the car and drove over to this men's retreat and did a fifth step with a guy and did six and seven that weekend and came home and started making amends. And I thank God that nobody held me back. That nobody tried to sit with me and read that book one night a week or something. I got active right away in sponsoring guys. 2 months sober, I was sponsoring guys. I think my effectiveness today might be a little better, but, you know, if we look at our history, that's where we come from. It's the sure and certain knowledge that my life depends on me reaching out to another alcoholic. It's not about head knowledge and book knowledge. It's about a simple heart-to-heart thing with another drunk. And that was demonstrated to me. So I got busy with amends. I had some amends that that little community I was raised in. Well, I mean, everybody's on the list, right? The whole town. How do you make amends to a town? I broke into every business in that town except the bank and the post office. I guess I had some intuitive thing about that's federal time, and I've already been there. I don't want to go back to that. But I did approach those people, and I had some good experiences. One of them was with our local grain elevator. I had broken into that place. You know, stole some stupid stuff. I tried to break into their safe. They had this really big safe, and I took a sledgehammer off the wall and was trying to man my way into that safe. And, you know, but anyway, I got a hold of the guy who owned it at that time and had to do some research because I wasn't sure who owned it. So I asked some people, and I got on the phone, and I found the guy, and I asked him, did you own the Shellsburg elevator back in like 1987 or whatever? Oh, it would have been earlier than that, 1981 or something. And he says, well, yeah, he said my dad was the primary shareholder, but my brothers and I had a piece in that elevator too. He says, why are you asking? Sometimes with amends, I really believe in listening to that intuitive voice. Most of the time, I want to do my amends face-to-face, but it was clear to me in that situation that I needed to talk to him over the phone. And he asked me why I wanted to know if he had been the owner. And I said, well, back in about 1981 or whatever, I broke into your business, and I want to make that right if I can. And, you know, I talked a little bit more about that, and he said, "Why are you doing this?" And sometimes I talk about being a member of AA and sometimes I don't. But I did then. I told him, "Well, I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm just trying to clean up my past here." And he said, "Really?" He says, "Where do you go to meetings?" I said, "Cedar Rapids, Iowa, primarily." And he seemed really intrigued by that. In fact, he almost seemed to get excited when I told him that. And we talked a little bit more, and I got to the part again about, you know, what can I do? I'll do anything I can to make this right with you. And I talked to him about what I took, and I talked about the safe I had tried to break into. Oh, he laughed when I told him about the safe. He said, "You know, it was open." Yeah. I never thought about doing that. Story of my life. But he said there wasn't anything in there, some change and stuff. But we got down to what I could do to make that right, and he says, "Well," he said that his dad was a member of that Alcoholics Anonymous outfit in Cedar Rapids, Iowa for the last 10 years of his life, and that was the best 10 years that his family had had together. And he said what he would like me to do is give back to that Alcoholics Anonymous group in Cedar Rapids until I was clear with it. He understood what I was doing. And so I've tried to do that. And I had a similar one with a outfit that I worked for on the road. I was a foreman for a roofing crew up and down the East Coast. And, oh boy, we could talk all night about that. I got asked never to come back to the state of Maryland on one of them runs. But I stole several thousand dollars from that roofing outfit. You know, they give me a stack of credit cards that thick and some, you know, a lot of overnight money. And so I went and I made an appointment with the owner of that company, and I sat with him and told him what I had done, and he understood what I was trying to do there too. When we got to what can I do to make this right, I said, "I'm willing to pay it all back." I said, "I don't know how much it was." I guessed. I told him I think it was about $12,000. I don't know though. And he asked me to do the same thing. He said, "What I'd like you to do is give back to that Cedar Rapids, that AA that you're going to. It seems to be doing good for you. Just give back to that in any way that you can until your conscience is clear," basically. And my conscience is clear of those things today. Absolutely. There's only one amend that I haven't been able to find. And that's to that lady that I married in San Francisco. I used to sit in AA meetings and say things like, "I stand ready to make that amend if God ever puts her in my life." Right? Like it's God's job. Thank God I got hooked up with some people later in my sobriety that got me into taking some action around that. And I've done everything that I've known how to do to try and find her. We've hired private investigators. I've done a lot of online work, and we just simply can't find her. So now I can say in all honesty that I do stand ready to make that amend if our paths ever do cross. I hope she's okay. I really do. I owe her. I was about 3 or 4 years sober, and I was riding to a lot of meetings with a guy from that little farming community. He became one of my early sponsors, and he was on the city council at the time, and I started talking to him about, like, community amends, right, because I was a hellion in that town. Fought everybody, been arrested out of both bars, you know, just you name it, done it. And I wanted to try and do something for the community and give back to that community that I had been so selfishly taken from my whole life. And like I said, he was on the city council. He says, "Well, you know, elections are coming up." He said, "Why don't you put your name in the hat for city council or something?" So I go in to the city clerk and tell her my intentions, that I'd like to throw my name in the hat, you know, to serve the city. And She said, "For what position, city council or mayor?" And guess which one I picked. Right. Why settle for second? So I threw my name in the hat for mayor, and they elected me to do that. Got to do that for two terms, as a matter of fact, and I did the very best I could for that community. We got a lot of neat stuff done, a lot of improvements with our city parks and parks. We had one park, little park. Embellish them. And got some potholes fixed that had been there for years and stuff like that. It was a nice time. It was good to do that, good to give back to that little town. I met another lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, Erica. We were married in 2004. My sponsor at the time married us. It was an incredible day. It's beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful. And we were blessed about 17 months ago with two little twin boys. They're a handful. They're beautiful. And when we got married, she had a young boy in her life at that time. I adopted him also, and just have a really good life today. Alcoholics Anonymous has done just a miracle with me. I still don't see how I got from there to here. And you know what's even neater about that for me is I see guys out in front of me that I still aspire to have a life like that, to have a spiritual freedom and relationships with people and with God. And whatever that power is that orchestrates our life, if we give up to it and just do what we do around here, man, I'm in for that. Well, since I'm in Vegas, maybe I should say I'm all in for that. Right? It's a neat deal. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to welcome the new people here. Sincerely welcome. And I hope that you find here the kindness, the love, the meanness, the understanding, the relationship with God, the freedom from alcohol and the alcoholism, and go after it. It's a neat deal. I love you guys. Thanks for my life.